You're listening to an exclusive podcast version of Panel Borders, Resonance FM's weekly show about the world of comics. I'm Alex Fitch, and on this week's show, continuing a series of episodes about anthropomorphic or funny animal comics, you'll hear the full-length interview I recorded with cartoonist Jim Medway about his online webcomic magazine Comical Animal. The interview was partially broadcast on 104.4 FM in London on the 16th of December 2010 and was recorded outside a busy pub near Euston, so you'll have to forgive the background noise. Before that, here's a word from our sponsors.
Resonance FM is London's only non-profit community radio art station, who need your donations to help keep the station and podcasts on air. All the program makers and all the engineers all work for free to bring you shows as diverse as The Bike Show, The Free University of the Airways, Hooting Yard, Speakers Resonance Corner. Resonance FM accepts donations in the form of cheques, credit and debit cards, bank transfers, PayPal and cash. Go to www.resonancefm.com for more details. We also accept hobnobs and teabags. Your donation means our continued existence.
I'm talking to Jim Medway. We're talking today because you've just launched a new webcomic anthology, Comical Animal. I know it's been a while since the DFC folded and therefore you had a regular venue to show your work in. Was it the frustration of that folding and there not being that many other print venues that attracted you that led to the creation of this webcomic?
I've always loved print. I'd much rather be doing this on paper, on the shelves, in people's hands. I kind of had a sort of half attempt with something called Garden Funnies, which I managed two issues of, and this was horticultural sequential art anthology where, rather than me drawing the whole thing, I kind of thought, well, let's try and get some other like-minded people to contribute. The comics I grew up with, it was never produced by just one person. It was always a Beano or a old Beezer annual or whatever, and you know, you'd have a whole range of stuff, so that model always kind of made sense to me. Garden Funnies, well, it went down well, and I was starting to build a nice model of doing it. It's distribution that's the problem. You know, there's never going to be any profit in small press. You know, you might as well forget about that from the start. So, and you're never going to be able to pay contributors. You know, if you're asking people to contribute, then, you know, you've got to give them something back. So, with Garden Funnies, I gave all the contributors 20 copies each, and that was the distribution model. You know, rather than me being responsible for, you know, sending packages out to various kind of benevolent comic shops around the country and getting £3 back. It's a waste of time. So I thought, you know, give them to the artists. They can do what they like with them. And who knows where these comics will end up. Then you just don't know the impact of it. You don't know who's reading it, who's getting to see it. So I kind of started thinking about, maybe the title came first, Comical Animal. It just added a kind of nice ring to it. I'm not a webcomics fan. You know, I don't want to spend any more time staring at the screen than I need to. But for now, this is how it's got to be, I think, you know. And I think I seem to have gathered enough interested artists, you know, with enough talent and skill and enthusiasm for this to make a fairly, I think it's a fairly decent issue every 2 months is the plan. Because I'm not paying anyone or myself, I'm not going to try and put new content up daily or weekly. You know, that's just unrealistic. So every 2 months for now. We'll see how it goes.
Cool. It seemed also, reading interviews with you recently, that part of the incentive was that there isn't much of a market or rather a place to find decent children's comics anymore. While the Beano and the Dandy seem to have improved their content of late and not just relied on the cheap toy that stuck to the cover to sell the comic, at the same time, there seems to be quite an absence of comics that are designed primarily to get new readers into the format. And I was particularly struck by the image that you came up with to partially promote Comical Animal, where there's a couple in a graphic novel shop and they're surrounded by dark and gritty comics, and you've got the caption underneath saying something like, "I thought this was a comic shop."
could have sworn it said comics outside. Yeah, the two kids kind of looking a bit frightened by all the covers of From Hell and Lost Girls and, you know, and Palestine and Joe Sacco books and things. So, yeah, all the best creators. And, you know, there's this amazing time in comics. There's just incredible stuff out there. But so little of it is for kids. I work a lot with kids. That's kind of how I make my living. I go to schools, galleries, libraries, youth groups, and I teach basic comic skills, and it's fantastic. But a lot of these kids, they just, you know, one or two out of 30 will have read a Beano in the last month, you know. That's, you know, and that's being generous. I'd maybe met one child who had read the DFC.
It did.
Some of them
read distribution model.
Well, it was a starting point. You know, the idea was it was going to eventually get onto the newsagent shelves, but because they take, was it 35% or something like that, you know, it wasn't realistic. But, you know, that's, I don't know. Who knows if the DFC will come back? I hope it does, because I think it was such a quality product. When I go into schools, a lot of the kids recognise Charlie Brown, but they don't know why, you know, they don't associate him with comics. Maybe they've seen him on a piece of merchandise or something. They might have seen an Asterix film, but never seen a book. One or two will recognise Tintin, but they just don't have access to these things because they don't go to the local libraries. That's not going to improve with libraries being hacked to pieces by the Tories. I don't know what I can kind of point kids towards to kind of get them in, you know, I work with mainly with sort of 10, 11 year olds, and that's the age when I was kind of really into comics, and I was picking up stuff from jumble sales, and this was kind of old British annuals and things. Beezer, Topper, Sparky, you know, and just fantastic, amazing, beautiful stuff. There's none of it anymore. Maybe it's the problem with the British model of you make it annual and then it's on the bookshelves at Christmas and then it disappears and it's old stock, it goes off. Yeah. You know, you can't sell an annual from 2 years ago in a bookshop. Maybe that's a problem. I mean, the French kind of do it a bit more intelligently, possibly. I'm not trying to describe Comical Animal as a kid's as a site for kids. It's for all ages, you know. The Beano is all ages, you know. There's more than just kids reading it. How would you know what the content's like, you know, if it was just for kids? So whether kids will access it or not, I don't know. I'd love to find out, you know, maybe a year down the line when it's built up a few more visits and subscribers and things. So we'll see.
And certainly some of the people that you have on board are other DFC veterans, for want of a better word, like Sarah McIntyre and
Gary Northfield. Phoenix.
Yeah, and Woodrow Phoenix. I mean, I've seen them at conventions sort of doing workshops as well. And so I imagine that there is actually kind of a grassroots movement between you and your peers trying to get, you know, younger readers and the creation of all ages titles. And it does seem that creating a website like yours is a good starting point, because it acts as a central hub that can send people then in the direction of the individual creator's own work, and vice versa.
Hopefully, yeah. I mean, Sarah McIntyre is fantastic. You know, she's got one foot in the comics world and one foot in children's books. You know, I don't really want to draw a strict line between the two, because, you know, they do overlap. Raymond Briggs, you know, took a long time for people to actually realise they were comics, which always sort of amuses me. Yeah, it's early days. We've kind of only just launched, and it's an experiment for me. You know, I have no idea if this is going to work. You know, this is, you know, I haven't got time to really dedicate to this, you know, as much as I'd like to. But I'm going to see how it goes. Feedback so far has been great, and if it builds up, then yeah, we might start really kind of focusing on targeting certain audiences, or providing, I don't know, you know, making a mini comic or children's books, or compiling the best strips every year to try and do something in print, just to try and reach a few more kids and adults. Adults can be kids too.
Indeed. Because it does seem that animal comics seem to be very much in the zeitgeist at the moment, both with the DFC titles that have been compiled, such as Vernon Lettuce and Good Dog, Bad Dog, and also other titles that may not even necessarily be for all ages, such as Brian Talbot's Gromville series. It seems like animal comics are coming back into fashion, and which almost begs the question, why do they ever go out of fashion?
Well, exactly. I just can't kind of pick out any particular animal comics or strips from my childhood, but it was definitely children's books. Richard Scarry, you know, top of my list. Just the world that he built with all these animals populated. I still love these books, and I'm still discovering new books by him. You know, he did 300 books in his lifetime. Never won any awards. Maybe because he was just so popular that nobody could see him. But I don't know. I think funny animals, you know, yeah, they've always kind of been here. You know, there's a comical animal at the website. I try and write a semi-intelligent essay for each issue. I did one for the preview batch of content, and I've done one for this first issue that's out. And I try to kind of write about anthropomorphism or consumer culture for kids, or something that's kind of not just a funny strip. I'm trying to kind of provoke a bit of a debate about stuff. I don't know if anyone fancies writing an article about funny animals in the zeitgeist and stuff. I have to confess, I've not read Brian Talbot's Gromville yet. But maybe I should.
Maybe he might write you an essay.
Well, yeah, if you're listening.
I mean, going off tangent, one thing that makes me angry is bad children's cartoons, which always seems to be that if they've got decent marketing and they put some furry animals in it, they'll make lots of money, even if the films themselves are actually rubbish. So it's kind of a double-edged sword.
You're referring to kind of Ice Age, things like that?
Well, Ice Age isn't too bad, but things like A Shark's Tale was god-awful. And you see so many trailers for films. Like, there was a 3D one about owls that came out recently that looked terrible. And it seems at least once a month there's a CGI animal cartoon in the cinema. And so while maybe animal comics are a great trend, animal animation is a bad trend, and we should be encouraging children to stop seeing the bad movies and start reading the good comics instead.
Well, all the best kid stuff is made to entertain kids and parents or adults at the same time. That's true of books and comics and films, and the lot. You know, it's the parents who have to pay for the film or the book. So, yeah, there needs to be a kind of filtering out of some of that crap.
I was looking back through your career in comics over the last decade, and things like the Crab Lane Crew, the book that you illustrated, Shorty Loves Wong Wing. It seems, I mean, I found you describing your own work actually as magical, naturalistic storytelling, and the way that you've depicted characters with cat's heads, at the same time you've taken the sort of anthropomorphic tradition to its most kind of kitchen sink, for want of a better word, that you're telling very realistic stories that unfold at the pace of real life, but adding these animalistic characteristics, so perhaps they have greater appeal than just things that are purely kitchen sink.
You make me sound productive here. I don't consider Crab Lane Crew as a funny animal strip. It's kids, but drawn as cat kids. I'd learnt to draw from Richard Scarry books when I was young, and then I kind of never got rid of that idea, and I've always struggled drawing humans. And when I was at college, I didn't do any drawing because there was all these other facilities to mess around with and have fun. And then as soon as I left college, I was broke again and I wanted to make something. And so I just started drawing again. And so I just started drawing exactly the same things I was drawing when I was 15 and 10 and 5. And it was these, you know, these kind of cat characters. I'd also been looking at a lot of kitchen sink realism and all these wonderful kind of films of the 60s, and I was starting to kind of observe people around me a lot more. So I kind of combined the way that I'd always been drawing with with what I was seeing around me. So I think with Crab Lane Crew, it was a lot nearer to a kind of warmth for characters and real kids than anything to do with Funny Animals or Scooby-Doo or anything like that. Crab Lane Crew, I like kids, and I think kids are funny, and I don't see why that isn't enough. You know, I don't think you need aliens and ninjas and robots and car crashes or, you know, or any of that.
Yeah.
Surely if kids are funny, isn't there a way of kind of putting kids into a comic strip, and couldn't that be funny? Mm. So with Crab Lane Crew, I was trying to not tell too much story in one episode. I'd have one incident and then I'd just have the kids messing about, teasing each other and joking, and I think at first people didn't really get it, and it didn't really make any sense because nobody knew who they were or where this was going. But then I think after a few weeks people kind of, I don't know if they saw themselves, you kind of join their gang a bit because you know them and you're spending time with them, and
yeah,
you develop a bit of relationship with them. And you know, it was nice. It was really sad that the DFC ended because I was, you know, about to have a big treehouse and summer fair, and I was really enjoying spending time with these kids. It's great.
Well, I hope eventually, and I'm not the first person to say this, that you'll finish it and there'll be a collected edition. But I mean, what I was going to say was, there seems to be this thing though that kids find animal characters perhaps more attractive to look at than human characters. And even as an adult, if you take something like Creature Comforts, by taking ordinary people's observations and putting them into the mouths of claymation animals, it somehow becomes greater than the sum of the parts. It becomes, in a way, more endearing and more humorous. And I wonder if that's something that you've noticed just as you've been doing the strips yourself.
Well, I think we've always used animals as symbols, you know, for emotions or traits, you know, poor as a church mouse or, you know, sly as a fox, this kind of thing. There's a wonderful biography of Richard Scarry where there's a quote from him where someone was asking him a very similar question, and he says that if you draw a girl with black hair, then a little girl with blonde hair isn't going to relate to it as much as if you just draw a girl bunny rabbit, and then the girl with black hair and the girl with blonde hair can both relate to that bunny rabbit. Mm. You know, they're very kind of open shapes that you can kind of put yourself into. Mm. And I think kids are kind of quite similar to animals in that they're, you know, they're feral or free range or protected, or they're seen as monsters, or they're seen as angels and innocent. You know, I'm hoping I can get some kids reading this stuff and get some feedback from them, get them drawing their own strips. We'll see, hopefully.
The earliest example of your work that I can find online is a contribution to an exhibition in the year 2000 called Life is Good in Manchester. Was it anthropomorphic characters you were drawing for that as well? And was that the first example of you putting your artwork out into the world?
I think it was, yeah. I think I left college and then, yeah, I started drawing pretty much straight away. And around the same time, I also found a small but pretty kind of vibrant and active artistic community in Manchester. There wasn't really much of an infrastructure for visual arts there. There was established galleries, but there wasn't much space for kind of interesting, new, exciting stuff. So I just kind of fell in with this small group of people who put on exhibitions in each other's flats and houses, and organising all sorts of interesting little things, and sort of one thing led to another, and then I kind of found myself, you know, with exhibitions showing my drawings, and then I guess I refined what I was trying to do with them. Maybe kind of 8 or 9 years on, I started getting a bit impatient with it and getting a bit restless about exhibiting. It's kind of been unsatisfactory having an exhibition. You know, all this work goes into it, then you put it up and people come and see it, and then they go home. And, and I just always loved books, and I've always loved comics. So I, kind of reached a point where I had to kind of hold my breath and take a big leap and force myself to draw more than one picture in a sequence. And it's a lot harder, and you've got to really stick to it and just sit down and get the work done. So I think doing the Crab Lane crew for the DFC was great for me, because it was my first proper deadline, a weekly deadline, so I just learnt so much from having to sit down and do it.
Was it similar characters you were drawing back in the year 2000, or have the themes changed considerably in your work over the past 10 years?
I think I was drawing far more kind of working class characters. Crab Lane crew were extremely middle class, as the DFC was, really. I am halfway through creating a 48-page booklet, comic book, call it what you want, called Playing Out, which is cat kids, but these are much more kind of working class kids, and there's no story, it's just these three lads wandering around Manchester City Centre being kicked out of shops for not contributing economically, bumping into people they know with very little consequence. So it's more like spending an afternoon with a bunch of kids. So it's kind of taking me back to this kind of social realism and observing normal characters and kind of finding that enough. Rather than fantasizing or creating worlds when there's one there already.
Before we started talking, I showed you Comical Animal on my Kindle, which is a way that you hadn't experienced it before. And knowing that people will perhaps be consuming it via iPads, iPhones, whatever, have you thought at all about those sort of forms of digital distribution? Because I'm not a big web comics reader myself, and I think that these kind of devices will perhaps actually be a much more enjoyable way of reading comics online.
Sure, definitely. I mean, I've not got an iPhone, I've not got a Kindle, I've not got an iPad, so yeah, no, I'm excited about the potential for this. I'd hate it to replace, you know, proper books, proper comics, things on paper. I think it's nice to have something you can actually lend to someone, or you can, you know, leave on a train by accident, or just pick up, or, you know, something that gets battered, something that gathers a bit of history, something that might have scribbles in it. But yeah, no, it's exciting. I think the next few issues, then I think I will try to kind of start to think about the way that the places that this could appear, you know, whether it's in people's pockets or on whatever they're reading on the train. This is all new to me. this web comics and Kindles and stuff, you know, I guess I need to get my head around it, really.
No, I mean, I think it's great that you've, you know, dove so deeply into it with a great product that will be updated on a regular basis with a lot of content.
Well, I'm glad you like it. I think it's great. I'm so pleased that I've got the contributors that I've got. They're all really, you know, talented and enthusiastic, and they're contributing these strips for free. There is a bit of a scheme we've got where hopefully sponsors will be able to adopt an animal, a cartoon animal, which kind of in turn is adopting a cartoonist, because you'd be paying, you know, £40-50 for three strips over three issues, which would go straight to the creator. So, you know, I'm hoping that I can encourage a little bit more of that, rather than just having ugly banner adverts or anything. I don't want it to become that kind of thing. I don't know, I think there's something kind of pure about books and proper comics, kids' comics, and I don't want it to kind of get polluted with, you know, the way that most other stuff gets polluted. Next one's going to be out in February the 3rd, and I'm hoping we're going to have some amazing strips again. And we've got maybe 140 subscribers so far. Subscribing, you don't get anything extra than someone who just visits the site, but you do get notification of when the new strips go up and you get a little email in your inbox, and you'll get access to other exclusive stuff as the site builds up. So and maybe we'll have a special kids club. Who knows? We'll see what happens.
For more info about Comical Animal, please go to www.comicalanimal.com. That's comicalanimal.com. In next week's show, the final panel borders of the year, you can hear my discussion with cartoonist Gary Northfield, who in the podcast is also joined by his studio mate and colourist Ellen Lindner, in an interview recorded at the Streatham Library Graphic Novel Readers Group. And we're talking about his strip, Derek the Sheep, which is featured in the Beano and Beano Max comics. You'll shortly be able to download that podcast, plus all the shows I've recorded this year, on my blog, www.panelborders.wordpress.com. In the meantime, American cartoonist Erica Moen, author of the hilarious and frank autobiographical comic Dar, which she describes as a super girly top secret comic diary, and she'll be in London for the opening of a gallery show at Orbital Comics, where you can see her paintings in real life and get a book signed or two. That's at Orbital Comics, 8 Great Newport Street, London, WC2H7JA. And the private view starts on Thursday the 30th of December 2010 at 5 p.m. More info at www.orbitalcomics.com. The broadcast version of Panel Borders will be back on Resonance FM in the second week of January. Thanks for listening.